Well, there's been a lot of comparisons that have been made about today's business cycle and the 1970s, the secular stagflationary period. And there's also been talk about us being in the midst of a soft landing. And one of the analogs that has been drummed up as a reference point is what we saw in 1994, where we were in the midst of, again, another major run in the technology space. The Fed was also raising interest rates during that period of time, but we did not see a recession. And we saw maybe a soft landing, if you want to call it that, but the economy chugged on for, you know, another 5 years or so before the next recession. So some people are saying that that's about where we are, and that we should be using that 94 analog as a reference for where the markets are currently. Today on the show to discuss this is Scott Freeman. He's at Variant Perception. And Scott, you just did a deep dive into this 1994 analog to show some of the ways in which we see some key, very key differences between then and now. Let's jump into that. What is your assessment of this analog that's being drummed up today?
The 1994 analog, it's gained some momentum, you know, whether it's Twitter, various research reports, et cetera, given that that is the only time that the Fed has hiked rates, what I'll say, aggressively, you know, by more than 250, 300 basis points without leading to a recession. And obviously, you know, about 550 basis points into this this hiking cycle, and we still have yet to see the economy slow down. There's a few key differences between why we don't think 1994 is necessarily a great analogy. The main thing is, or the two main things are the current labor market dynamics, the dynamics of labor hoarding, but also, you know, something that's been very obvious is the impact that fiscal deficit spending has had on U.S. economic resilience. And both of those, the labor market, current labor market dynamics and fiscal dynamics, are much more, create a lot more inflationary upside risk today than we saw in the mid-90s. And if you look at the breakdown of government spending versus household savings throughout history, until like all of American history, fiscal deficits have decreased when household saving rates are increasing. I mean, that makes natural sense. Households are either spending more, it's putting money in the economy, there's not as much need for fiscal. But if you look at today, it's the opposite. Household saving rates are unbelievably low, while fiscal deficit spending, you know, has continued to increase. And importantly, we're in the viewpoint that the dependence on fiscal isn't going to go away. It's, you know, somewhat ingrained to the structure of the United States. So that's one. And then the second aspect of that is, you know, within the labor market in the 90s, you're coming off the 1990-91 recessionary period. The starting point within the labor market was, you know, from a looking at firms with jobs not able to fill right now, was much lower. And you were coming off, you know, very high levels of unemployment. I think, you know, after the recession, it was 8-9%. So there's a lot of labor out there that could meet the growing demand within the labor market that was being fueled. You know, you mentioned the internet bubble by a surge in private investment spending, given, you know, the internet boom. And that's what allowed the inflationary cycle or the disinflationary boom to play out in the 90s versus today, when you have a lot more inflation upside risks. The last point I would make is, you know, the Fed in 94, when they hiked rates, leading growth indicators were strong and did not detract throughout the rest of the decade, even after the hiking cycle took place, given, you know, the private investment boom, the internet boom surge that we're seeing. Where today, when the Fed, you know, started hiking, leading growth indicators were extremely poor, but they kept on hiking regardless. So pretty much that's how I would summarize it. The disinflationary boom aspect of the 90s is very different than the inflationary upside risk we're seeing today, given the fiscal and labor dynamics. And, you know, there's a lot of talk around AI and the productivity boom that we could see from that. But I would make a stronger bet on that. Those types of cycles take a long time to play out, and there is room for private investment to expand in the U.S. But just given the inflationary upside risks we have today, I don't think that backdrop is necessarily the same as we saw in the 90s.
Two things that we do see that are very similar to that period and today is, if you look at the number of mentions of artificial intelligence in corporate filings, it's about where we saw mentions of website or internet during that late 90s period. But that was not the mid 90s, this 94 period. This was closer to, you know, the 1998 to 2000, towards the peak, where you saw a lot of euphoria, enthusiasm, tons and tons of corporate calls, even from executives that don't have anything to do, or companies with jobs in AI talking about AI. So we see the same level of euphoria there. And then also just the weight of high momentum stocks in the equity markets currently, you know, it's comparable to what we saw in that late 90s period. So those are two things that are kind of sticking out pretty strongly. But again, that lines up more towards that we're in a bubble versus us being in the middle of that process. And one thing that you mentioned is, you know, this disinflationary boom, right? This analog of 1994 to today, where we did see a disinflationary boom. Right now, correct me if I'm wrong, but it really looks like we're seeing the inflation measures, especially if you're looking at over a 3-month or 6-month basis. I mean, they're starting to accelerate higher off that 3% level. Some people are saying that it looks like we may be putting in a trough around 3% on the main CPI. What are your thoughts on that?
So looking at our US inflation LEI, it appears to have put in a bottom. The uptrend isn't necessarily profound, but it definitely appears to have put in a bottom. And that in large part, is to the fiscal and labor market dynamics that I had just mentioned. And the same story goes for inflation expectations. So right now, our view on inflation is, with fiscal and labor, in addition to something we've been tracking pretty closely recently, is the inventory cycle and how, COVID created a huge distortion in manufacturer inventories relative to customer inventories, where customer inventories were greatly exceeding manufacturing inventories. And that gap has now reversed, which is somewhat of a signal to us that we actually can start to get, a inventory cycle normalization and rebound, a more traditional, like standard inventory cycle rebuild, similar to history, given that the distortions have now started to fade. But then you look at PPI today or ISM prices paid, that in and of itself also adds, dynamics of inflation upside risk. So while the outlook for inflation, I don't think we're heading towards 10% or the hyperinflation deficit driven type scenarios, but I think there are like lots of cyclical upside pressures that aren't very much being priced in by the market. And I would be hesitant until fiscal fades to discount the probability of higher inflation. So that's kind of how we're thinking about structuring portfolios, is we want to play, get exposure assets with upside risk to inflation, particularly real assets is one of our core beliefs. But that being said, I wouldn't say our outlook is that inflation is going to surge back, but there are quite a few cyclical risks to keep up things propped up, maybe around the 3-4% type level for the, next 6-12 months.
Yeah, so that's how we're thinking about it too, is that we're probably seeing a trough around that 3% level. We're not necessarily thinking that we're going to return back to those 1970s levels, just because of the massive change that we've seen to how the U.S. economy is structured and operates currently, heavily services versus manufacturing back then. There's a number of reasons to think that we won't get back to, double digit inflation. But like you said, there is a tailwind for higher inflation here. And we could be looking at 3.5-4%, depending on how the data plays out. And again, a lot of this does have to do with just how much fiscal stimulus is coming to help the economy chug along. $6 trillion spent last year, over $6 trillion expected to be spent this year. That's certainly having somewhat of an influence there. One thing that I want to ask you about is labor market, because there's been a lot of attention on the labor market. It seems like some of the more real-time measures that have been coming in are showing that the job market is really starting to soften. And that's another important difference between what we saw in 1994 and today. What are you seeing from the labor market front?
Yeah, so the under the hood distortions in the labor market are pretty severe to history. There's so many contradictory signals, whether it's WARN notices versus the unemployment rate, et cetera. And a very staunch divergence that we've seen is the outlook of U.S. consumers. And they right now, according to the Conference Board, U.S. Citizens view the ability to get a job as it's never been easier. That if they need to go and enter the labor market, they will be able to get a job. But if you look at then personal finance survey, you know, the current status of personal finances within a household, they've deteriorated quite a bit. And we think that's being really driven by decline that we've seen in real wages. And since COVID, you know, real wages have troughed and have yet to really rebound. And that has explained a lot why these personal finance surveys are not good. And so if you have, you know, a personal finance survey outlook that's not good, but people view the ability to get a job very easily, that's going to put upward pressure on real wages, which is, that's the underarching thesis of our, you know, we call it our Godot's recession thesis, of what that's what we'll call cause these labor hoarding dynamics to break when the upward pressure on real wages comes. And we think that in part of what this, the resilience in the labor market has been, is if you look at the job opening data, if you look at US companies with 10 or more employees, you know, right after COVID, both job openings and hires surged and have since, you know, corrected in unison. That, you know, it's a historically extremely correlated data series, openings versus hires. And that had that, you know, experienced this normal pattern or the surge and then, you know, contraction post COVID, you know, whether you think about, you know, UPS layoffs that you've seen in headlines, et cetera. But if you look at the micro business level, so that's companies with 1 to 9 employees, these companies have been unable to hire workers since COVID, despite having a surge in job openings. You know, this is a pretty you know, material portion of the job market. And so we think that has helped explain, or that is a key driver of why you've seen some of this really, you know, resilient headline US labor market data. But what we think will cause that to break eventually is when, you know, this upward pressure on real wages starts to amount, which is, you know, we're starting to see some signs, you know, plans to raise compensation for small businesses are rising at a greater rate than plans to raise prices, which means that, you know, companies are starting to cave to these labor hoarding driven, you know, higher real wage demands from consumers. So that is what we think has been propping up the labor market. And but also in addition to that, has been fiscal spending. It's been, you know, unbelievably stimulative across the economy, which has helped explain a lot of these divergences, which is why the labor market outlook and this labor hoarding dynamic along with fiscal are the two key macro themes in addition to inflation that we are really, really tracking closely.
Yeah. And, you know, going back to this 1994 analog, one of the pieces of data that we follow here at our firm when it comes to looking at the health of the U.S. employment labor market is the percent of states that see rising unemployment levels. And this is something we've been featuring over the past couple of months or so. And Jeff Gundlach actually just featured this in his most recent webinar as well. But when you look at the percent of states with rising unemployment rates, if you look at it on a 12-month moving average or just one-year basis, that data is currently, and this was just updated, so this is current up through January of this year, that's currently standing at 86%. So that is 86% of states in the U.S. now have rising unemployment rates. And if you look at that chart, I'll post it where this interview is located on Financial Sense. But if you look at that chart, that's at a level that is typically only seen within a recession. And I mean, going back to this 1994 analog, there were no states, very little states with rising unemployment rates during that time. So the data, at least on the labor market from the state data, is pretty alarming. So it's kind of hard to figure out, you know, what's going to happen with the labor data going forward. But this is giving you a very alarming picture.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that, you know, to your point about the 90s, you know, that's a key aspect of why we don't think it's necessarily comparable, because like you said, you know, we were coming out of a recession when the Fed started to hike rates. The unemployment was already very high and the base level of labor market demand was much, much lower. And labor demand was allowed to expand and be met by, you know, a lot of people were already out of work. Where now it's just, that's not the case. In your point, you're seeing those types of indicators that are literally signaling the opposite kind of dynamic. So yeah, no, we agree, but it will just be interesting to track how long the Godot's recession thesis, which I keep mentioning, is all about how inflation can mask, delay the inevitable effects of negative feedback loops. And it's going to be, in fiscal is a big part of that. So it's going to be, we just have to kind of wait and see how fiscal plays out. and how that continually works its way into the labor market. But you know, when things start to break in those types of environments, they tend to break quickly, which is also another reason why we don't think fiscal is going to go anywhere. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how things play out. And that is, you know, to your point, I think a key reason we don't view today like 1994.
Yeah. And to your point on that, you know, I mean, with the implementation of modern monetary theory, as we see today post COVID, you know, immediately when we saw the lockdowns, I mean, there was just a massive amount of cash that was funneled to consumers directly to their bank accounts, helicopter money, as Ben Bernanke used to call it, you know, just throw the money out of the helicopters. Once a policy like that is implemented at a sufficient scale, as we saw during the COVID period, it's really easy for the government to enact that policy again and again. You know, it just becomes kind of ingrained. So like you say, if we start to see the more red flags and the government becomes aware of it and the financial markets are starting to get a little in a panic mode, it's going to be pretty easy just to say, oh, hey, we're going to send stimulus checks out to whatever income bracket. You know, it doesn't have to be all Americans, of course, but maybe we'll send it out to lower income Americans. But we're just spending like drunken sailors.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. And that's why, you know, financial repression, without a doubt, is the path of least resistance in the U.S. And I'll be clear, I do not think the U.S. is going to enter a period of hyperinflation, but that explains why every hyperinflation scenario in history has been a result of significant deficit spending. Because for governments, you know, it's easier to borrow and try to inflate, you know, the debt away than raise taxes, especially in a now, you know, fiat world, also in a world where political polarization is much more staunch than, you know, a lot of periods in history, which makes it even harder to, you know, take a austerity approach to fiscal policy. So I agree. It is a perk of, you know, having the reserve currency of the world. But nonetheless, I don't think that is going to change. I very much view financial repression will be the outcome versus, you know, any kind of fiscal austerity.
Well, Scott, as we close today's interview, again, you're pointing out a number of charts here in your analysis today that the comparisons between 1994 and today with the disinflationary boom, there's a lot of very key differences here. We picked through some of those. With that said, would you mind telling our listeners a little bit more about variant perception, the best way to get their hands on your research?
Yeah, so you can visit us at variantperception.com and, you know, request a demo to our client portal and also get a feel for, you know, some of our white papers and our investment approach. We have a Twitter at VRNT Perception and also a Substack blog where we try to share high level anecdotes of our investment framework. That'd be where you can find us. And, you know, feel free to reach out to anyone, info at Variant Perception, any contact you see on our website. And we're happy to get in touch with you.
If you have any questions or feedback on what we discussed today, or if you'd like to get in touch with us at Financial Sense Wealth Management, feel free to check out our new website, financialsensewealth.com, or you can give us a call at 888-486-3939. For FS Insider, I'm Chris Sheridan. Thanks for listening.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.